For the week of May 6th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 146, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at St. Vincent's Hospital in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Gills.
Yes, I guess we should explain. You're in Alabama with your father.
That's right. I'm with my family helping out my dad. He had colon cancer surgery. The surgery went well, but the recovery has been difficult. Anesthesia will mess with your mind, especially when you're 85 years old. Here's a tip for you. If you want to get well, it's a good idea not to try to yank out your catheter every 5 minutes, and don't try to stand up if you're too weak and you'll fall on the floor. That's just a suggestion.
And actually, quite honestly, hearing about yanking out one's catheter every 5 minutes makes me not want to stand up at all.
That's true. But I've been with my family. We appreciate the people who texted and called and emailed and wondering what was going on. When a show is significantly delayed or we're skipping a week, we try to mention it the show before, or if it was an emergency like this, we do post on our Twitter feed. So if you're a little confused, you can always check Twitter feed and roll back a little bit and see if we've mentioned it. But we're apologizing. Here we are now. Let's get on with the show. But speaking of illness, on a sort of a sadder note, a couple of people died in the last 2 weeks.
That's true. Now, we have been off 2 weeks, and I don't want to belabor the point because you covered it quite well, but I have to say, I was really kind of touched and I'm very pleased to see all of these emails coming in asking, you know, what's up? Why haven't we had a show in the last 2 weeks? I mean, we know that people are out there listening because we do get your emails, but it's really heartening to receive them when we don't post a show. In any case,
given the power and the money and the influence that we've accumulated by doing this show, I think we owe it to them to be as consistent and regular as possible.
That is true. And I think the money part is really what you're referring to.
Where it's at.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Right.
But speaking of money, Dick Clark was a very wealthy man. He had his whole empire there with the Golden Globes and Dick Clark Productions and an American Bandstand. 30 years that show was on the air, and he passed away at the age of 82 2 weeks ago.
Mr. New Year's Eve, that's right. Also dying, speaking of music, was Adam Yauch of the Beastie Boys. And being in New York, like I would have been, I could have seen some of the tributes, but there were some spontaneous tributes in the Lower East Side. You could hear the Beastie Boys music playing everywhere. What I really liked to see was R&B stations, urban stations, stations that people who like black music, quote-unquote black music, listen to, playing some Beastie Boys song and giving credit to them. They were, you know, a serious hip-hop band. They earned their credibility. They were accepted into that world, and it was really cool to hear that on the radio, that they were tipping their hat to the Beastie Boys. So it's sorry to see him go.
Yeah, you know, I was a little surprised at the outpouring of, I mean, certainly I knew him. I went to school with him. He was ahead of me in school, but, you know, as was Rick Rubin, who was the RA at Weinstein Hall at NYU when I was there. But I was a little surprised that, you know, there was such an outpouring of...
Sperling, you're old.
Ugh, yeah.
They've been around for like 25 years. That's a long time in rock and roll.
I know. Well, 30 years.
They started young.
30 years for Dick Clark on American Bandstand and 25 years for Adam Yauch and the Beastie Boys. And they were just inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame 2 weeks ago. So
He wasn't there because he was too ill, I believe.
Yes,
right?
That is correct. Yes.
That's right. But it was nice that they were able to get that tribute. And finally, children's author Maurice Sendak, best known, of course, for Where the Wild Things Are and a host of other great books. He passed away as well, a long, successful career, and his work will live forever as long as there are children who need to go to sleep.
Yes, that is true. Although, you know, it's funny because I actually read that book to my children, and they were pretty scared when they were younger. You know, you wouldn't
and
think it's
a,
it's,
and
like,
it's a good movie. You should check it out again.
Yeah, you'd think, look, it's a picture book. How could you be scared of this? But, you know, they actually, you know, when they're 3-4 years old, they get scared. He must have known what he was doing.
So what are we going to cover this week?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I guess I was at CinemaCon, so we can talk about that. Obviously, we're going to have to talk about, you know, there's Rick Ross over at Disney. He's no longer there. He was the head of Disney. The Tony nominations were announced a week or so ago. And then we have Big Deal or Big Whoop, of course. We'll end with some inside baseball. And
YMCA.
That's right. An update on the copyright laws and a ruling in a landmark ruling, in fact, in a copyright case. But first, you know, as always, even when we're delayed a week or two, we always begin with entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gilts filling us in on the weekend's box office, and you've got a lot to cover this week.
No, we don't. Not really. We have one movie to cover, and that, of course, is Marvel's The Avengers, which is one of the biggest openings of all time. The biggest opening of all time. What am I talking about? Let's cover 2 and Lower first to see what all the other movies are about, because they're not as important. Let's get them out of the way. Number 2 at the box office around the world was American Reunion, which opened in a lot more territories. It made $35 million this weekend, and that's at $172 million worldwide and counting. And number 3 around the world is Battleship, the Taylor Lautner film. It's only opened overseas. It made $11 million last weekend. It's at $200 million worldwide and counting. It opens up in North America any day now.
Is that Taylor Lautner or Taylor Kitsch?
I beg your pardon, Taylor Kitsch. Taylor Lautner is, of course, Twilight.
Yes.
I'm getting my Taylors confused. Taylor Swift, of course, will be in the upcoming film Les Miserables. But anyway, at number 4 around the world is The Lucky One, the Zac Efron movie that made $11 million worldwide. It's at $66 million and counting. Number 5, The Hunger Games, made another $10 million. It's at $617 million worldwide. It seems like just a minute ago it set a huge record for opening weekend box office, one of the biggest of all time, and it's already being eclipsed by Avengers. And number 6, The Pirates, Band of Misfits, the animated film from the Aardman Studios, the people who do Wallace and Gromit. The Pirates made $8 million around the world. It's at $89 million and counting. And number 7 is Think Like a Man. That made $8 million worldwide, essentially in North America only. It's made $73 million. Will it open overseas? The Tyler Perry movies almost never do. Films with black themes aren't really opened overseas, so they don't build an audience, so they don't get a chance. So Hollywood says they won't make money. And then every once in a while, of course, they do, like anything by Will Smith. But I'm not sure. I think it's the cart before the horse. And Africa, of course, is a huge territory that hasn't remotely begun to tap its potential. Someday, 10, 20 years from now, Africa will be a major force in box office, just like India and China are becoming or already are. And we'll see movies making a lot of money there. But right now, it's made $73 million in North America, and overseas awaits. At number 8 is The 5-Year Engagement, the not terribly good Jason Segel movie. It made $7 million. It's at $21 million and counting. Titanic 3D made another $4 million. It's at $333 million worldwide for its 3D reissue. Number 10 is a French film, Le Prénom, at $3.4 million. It's in France only. 21 Jump Street made another $3.4 million. It's at $180 million worldwide. The Lorax just broke past $300 million worldwide. The Raven, which we missed its opening last week, and that's a John Cusack movie about Edgar Allan Poe as a detective helping to track down a serial killer. That's in North America, basically. It made another $2.5 million. It's at $12 million and holding softly. And number 14 is the new Jason Statham film, another action flick. It's at $12 million total and counting. And number 15, its second weekend in Italy, is a new Woody Allen movie. It's opened in Italy alone. It's called To Rome With Love. So now you understand why it's there. It's made $10 million in that country alone. I think Woody Allen has a new marketing plan. He's going to continue to make one film for every city in the world. And by God, they'll all make money, at least in that country.
That's true. Yes. But you know,
opening small in the U.S. as counter programming, perhaps, is our old friend, the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. It made another $2 million worldwide. It's at $73 million in counting, and it's finally opened in a few major cities in North America. It made a quite strong $27,000 per screen average. So we look forward to that. And there's one more movie to talk about.
And what movie is that,
It's Marvel's The Avengers. It's the only thing I've done in the last 2 weeks. I did take 3 hours away from the hospital and get to the movies to see the biggest movie ever.
Take 3 hours to because it's a 2.5-hour movie.
That's right. The Avengers, in its second weekend worldwide, made $364 million. As of the weekend, it had made $654 million in counting. Now we're over $700 million in just the first 13 days. It's the biggest opening weekend of all time by a big factor. In fact, the original estimate was that its opening weekend in North America, it had made $200.4 million, something like that. And I thought, I bet the studio squeezed out an extra couple hundred thousand just to make sure they hit that magic 200 million. You know, they were so close, I thought they couldn't bear to say 199. But in fact,
they actually made a couple
of,
they squeezed out a couple of extra million dollars, not just a couple extra $100,000.
That's right. They made so much money on Sunday that they said they made $207 million in North America in its opening weekend here. And because movies have only opened so widely in the last 10, 20 years, almost all the top grossing films of all time in an opening weekend are from the last 3 or 4 years. And that means that even if you look at ticket sales, this probably really is the biggest film of all time in its opening weekend. Because movies like Gone with the Wind, even up to Jaws in the 70s, they just didn't open on this many screens. They didn't have the capability. So, in fact, you know, you don't have to adjust for inflation. You don't have to do anything. Marvel's The Avengers probably did have the biggest opening weekend of all time.
Yeah, I mean, films like even The Godfather or Jaws, they would go...
Well, massive hits.
Massive hits, but like The Godfather would go on tour and play in certain cities for a year at a time.
And that people would be lined up around the block. Now, even on opening weekend, even when it's such a massively popular film, you can go see The Avengers and get a ticket with a little planning, especially in major cities. Here in Birmingham, I have to say, not to run down the city that my family lives in, but this is not a heavy movie-going town. I could have bought a ticket on Saturday night, like 20 minutes before the movie opened. I mean, it was just like, I'm like, come on. I thought we'd have to be there like 40 minutes early, make sure we got a good seat. I made my niece and nephew come here like, you know, 20 minutes 30 minutes before showtime. And they were like, oh, Uncle Michael, that's really not necessary. And we were there before anybody in the theater. But that's okay. We had the best seats and we had fun.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess it's not like, say, Chicago or New York or L.A., right, where if you did that there, you wouldn't have a seat. You wouldn't have a ticket.
Now, here's one fascinating detail. The Hollywood Reporter says that 52% of ticket sales were for the movie in 3D. That strikes me as awfully low.
Well, it's about where 3D has averaged out, especially on a movie like The Avengers, where it's converted, where it's not like Avatar, where one of the big pluses of the film or one of the big attractions of the film is the fact that it's in 3D.
Well, I saw it in 2D and it played great. I didn't miss it at all. People who saw it in 3D said, don't worry about it. You're not going to miss anything. I think that's a lot of resistance. It's opening week and you want to see the movie. It's cool the way it's a big event and barely half of the people saw it in 3D. I think it's going to be a few months from now, we're going to see a big movie like this open up in 3D and less than half is going to be 3D. I think it's going to continue dropping because I bet second weekend is much lower because why pay the extra? But in fact, the 3D surcharge accounted for about $30 million of that $207 million opening weekend. That means even if it hadn't been released in 3D, it would have made $177 million and still been the biggest opening weekend of all time.
Now, do you think this year that The Dark Knight Rises will actually top Marvel's The Avengers?
I guarantee Dark Knight Rises. That was my next comment. Enjoy it while you can, because this record will last until July 20th when The Dark Knight Rises opens. For some bizarre reason, people want to see Batman opening weekend. It's been happening since the Michael Keaton film in 1989. Almost every time a new Batman film opens, an exception being Batman and Robin, for example, and the relaunch of the film with Batman Begins, almost every time they set a new box office record for opening weekend. Almost every time it is the biggest opening weekend of all time. It happened with Batman. It's going to happen again. It happened again with Dark Knight. It's going to happen again with The Dark Knight Rises. This will, I bet it beats the $207 million mark. It's going to be a big mountain to climb, and it may not make it, but I bet they're gunning for it, and I bet it's going to happen. I'm going to lay down my money, and hey, I picked the Kentucky Derby, right? I'll have another. So I'm going to double down and say Dark Knight Rises does, in fact, topple the record. It won't be a failure, of course, if it doesn't. It can make, you know, if it makes 150 million, people will say, oh, it's only the fourth biggest opener of all time. What's wrong with the Batman franchise?
Well, so it's not in 3D, first of all. So right off the bat, I'd say, you know, that $30 million, technically it could have made, say, maybe $180 million if it was in 3D. So
it's dollar figures that we're comparing, not ticket sales and not, you know, plus or minus 3D. They got you to pay extra for 3D. They deserve the credit. So the number it has to beat is $207 million. I'm looking forward to July 20th.
You know what's interesting about this week's box office, and frankly, the box office from the past 4 weeks, is that, you know, much like you were talking about, Think Like a Man, where African-American movies don't go overseas because certain studios or all the studios feel like, well, African-American movies are, they don't travel, they don't translate. They may want to rethink that, because when you look at a movie like Battleship and a movie like The Avengers, these are movies that are opening overseas first, and there are very, you know, there are reasons that that's happening right now. And
but those are worldwide blockbusters. Those aren't geared towards a particular audience.
Right.
They're not dramas. They're big spectacles.
That's true. And you would normally never have seen that. And this is really changing the way people think about release patterns, especially for these big blockbuster films. You can hear industry executives talking about how they're going to change release patterns based on the success of these two films.
Yes. No, I mean, it's clearly that they're, you know, they look at the summer box office and they look at football, you know, European soccer, I should say. And they say, hey, that's not, you know, why not open it when it makes the most sense with the calendar for Europe and for other markets? You know, they always want to open these big movies within a few weeks of each other. It's not like they want to wait 6 months anymore. So day and date has been a big trend for a while. But you know what? If 3 weeks early makes sense in Europe, it's not going to hurt a movie in North America. In fact, they feel like opening The Avengers early helped a lot, because it was a big event and told people, hey, this is not just for comic book geeks. This is a movie for everybody. You know, it was a big event in Europe. It had huge numbers, and that helped build the buzz for North America and let them know this isn't just, you know, Thor.
Well, with the internet, you know, it used to be that you would want to open your movie in the U.S. first because it'll do big numbers for a blockbuster like The Avengers, and then word will spread overseas, and that will get the press overseas and the exhibitors overseas all excited to book the film and to hype the film in media reports. Well, now with the internet, it can work either way. So
absolutely, it always could, but they just thought, you know, they didn't place as much emphasis on worldwide box office.
That's true. Yes.
So you were at CinemaCon. CinemaCon is that basically where the Hollywood studios come? Is it sort of like the network up front where the TV networks come and say, hey, here are our new fall shows? They're talking to advertisers. CinemaCon, I think, is studios coming to all the theater distributors and saying, hey, here's the product we have coming up. Get excited.
Yeah, that's actually a very good way. I've never heard it put that way, but that's a very accurate description, the upfronts. I like that. I think I may steal that. And
that's why I make the big bucks.
Yeah, well, you know, it occurred.
And by big bucks, I mean bitcoins, because I don't make real money doing this.
Well, CinemaCon was like a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. It occurred right after Mr. Rich Ross, quote unquote, left Disney. Of course, he was partly responsible for the flop that was John Carter, but you wait 2 months and all of a sudden you have this big $207 million opening with The Avengers at the same
studio. Was he responsible for signing up Marvel? Because this is the first film that Disney has released since it purchased Marvel. Did Rick Ross, was he a big player in making that purchase happen?
No, he was not, because that happened long before he was ever chairman of the studio.
So he doesn't get any credit anyway.
So yeah, I mean, and that's why, you know, look, he left or was kind of shot, if you will. And so that was kind of hanging over CinemaCon. But you're right. A lot of filmmakers showed up and the studios kind of do a dog and pony show with bringing all of these stars out for each of their upcoming films. Universal has a very impressive slate of really interesting movies, including, by the way, you mentioned Les Mis. They showed maybe 5 minutes of
Les Mis. Do you hear the people singing a song of angry men?
Well, they didn't play that song. I can't remember the song they played. It's the famous
One Day More, I imagine. One Day More, the big rousing first act finale?
No, it's the kind of ballad that
sung by Jean Valjean or by the girl?
By the girl.
Oh, like On My Own? On my own, the pavement shines like silver. That one?
No, it's the
we're going to work our way through the score.
I can't.
We're going to sing them all, as Judy Garland
said. It's Cosette, you know, the she sings
Castle in the Sky?
Yes, I believe so.
I'm not going to sing that one. That's for an 8-year-old girl.
Yeah, well, actually, no, maybe it was On My Own. I don't know. Either way, it was Anne Hathaway singing it.
It was On My Own.
On My Own. Okay, so she sings this thing, and she's singing live. I mean, they only had the first couple of days of footage, and they cut this thing together. It looks phenomenal. She sounded great.
What do you mean she's singing live?
They actually just recorded the audio live. They just said, okay, this was her singing on set.
That's not necessarily what they're going to use in the film, though.
Correct, yeah, no, but it worked. I mean, they could use it in the film. I mean, people were blown away by it.
Well, you know, they got a lot of musicals coming to television. One of my favorite shows of the last few years is Friday Night Lights. And Connie Britton, who is the mom in that show, a terrific actress, she's starring in a new musical show called Nashville, and she's singing in that. So music is where it's at lately.
Yeah, and you know, another Savages, Oliver Stone's next film, looks really, really good.
Well, there were a ton of films. What film flopped? What film did not play well with the distributors? What sort of left them cold? What was a notable movie where they were like, eh?
Well, in this case, it's the distributors who are the studios showing films to movie theater owners or exhibitors. So,
exhibitors. I used the wrong word. So what film made exhibitors turn up their nose?
Well, I think just about everybody who read any type of newspaper or media coverage of any kind from this event knows that it was Peter Jackson's The Hobbit.
No, I want to save that for last. That didn't make them turn up their nose. That's a different issue.
That's a different issue. Yes, that is correct. Yes. We can get into that in a moment.
Yes. What other film that they are excited by? And they're still excited by The Hobbit. Don't get them wrong. What film? They're all going to want to show it. What film are they like, I don't know if I want to book that.
You know, I didn't go to all of the presentations because I had various meetings.
What's the word on the street, Sperling?
The word on the street is The Life of Pi is phenomenal. This is the Ang Lee adaptation of the best-selling novel.
Which I have not read.
And it's in 3D, And apparently everybody went berserk for it.
Why would Life of Pi be in 3D? Ugh.
Apparently it looks amazing.
I am so over 3D, I have to tell you. I'm just completely, everybody I know who sees 3D now, they feel bludgeoned into it and they watch and they think, why did I bother? I hear that again and again from regular folk. Why did I bother? I heard that about the Avengers. I hear that about every single movie out there. They think it's not, there's no point. You know, it's not like color or sound or, you know, like Blu-ray or DVD compared to VHS where you look at it and you meet, or you get a flat screen TV. You put a flat screen TV in your home and you go, wow, that is unbelievable. You get a movie in color for the first time. You go, wow, 3D? Nobody goes, wow. Nobody cares. Nobody is excited by a movie in 3D. That's why I think this has got to end. This is just a ridiculous gimmick. It does not, you can make a movie nicely in 3D, but it's not important. I really feel that strongly. And 3D television is ridiculous.
I think here's the reason that you're seeing this. Now, CinemaCon is a trade show. It is a convention for business people. It's not a, like a CinemaCon, or sorry, a Comic-Con where you see, you know, fans show up. They are thinking of maybe trying to turn it into that, which would be an interesting and probably a smart idea. But it's really, it's there for the industry. And so you get a lot of these vendors like Dolby, like Doremi, like Real D, sitting there and selling their wares to movie theater owners and cinema integrators. And
buy a new 3D setup, buy a new projector.
Right. Well, the reality is that when the Hollywood studios got together to form the Digital Cinema Initiative, they put out a specification that said, look, no proprietary technology. So all of those sound formats like Dolby were done away with. The one thing they didn't cover was 3D. So the only place where you could put a proprietary technology and value-added technology in place and may actually make money on it, not and maybe have something that your competitor didn't have, well, that was 3D. And now,
and it's been a disaster.
And now what's happening is you are beginning to see all of these companies like Dolby. Again, Dolby launched what was called Atmos. They have this new sound format that can have up to, I don't even know, like 100 and some odd channels of audio. So it's all this sound field acoustics so that you actually place objects within the room. And if depending on where you're sitting in the room, it will sound like it's coming from that one specific point. And, you know, there's ImSound and Barco's Oro 3D. So this whole idea of 3D sound is now becoming a big thing. Why? Because all of these companies need something to sell.
We have surround sound. We have helicopters coming behind you and all that. It's just another refinement of that.
Well, this is
and
actually
make it different. Sound more exciting by instead of surround sound, they call it 3D sound.
Well, yeah, I mean,
I don't want to pay extra for it. I don't want a surcharge on my ticket. I'll tell you that. I'm going to avoid it. I'm going to avoid it like the plague.
Well, the big thing is you need all of these extra speakers and channels to actually make the thing work. Iosono, for instance, has, I think, you know, 200 channels. Well, how do you actually play?
Theaters can't even use the 3D projectors they have right now properly. You know, they've invested all this money in 3D projectors and they're finding decreasing revenue from people less and less wanting to see a movie in 3D. They're hard to operate. People complain. I don't think people are going to be toting up big bucks in order to have 100 speakers in their theater.
Well, having heard some of the demonstrations, they are impressive. The sound is phenomenal. It does cost more money to actually produce that sound, both from a mixing standpoint and from a playback standpoint. You do need all those extra speakers. It isn't surround sound. It is a different technology.
It's even better.
But at the same time, you kind of go, okay, well, is it enough of a value add that it's worth going through all of this? And the industry is just looking for some way to attract people out of their homes. And also the companies and the technology vendors inside the industry are looking for some way to actually have something new and something that's worth paying for.
They just want to charge more money to theater owners. Good picture quality, good sound, and good movies brings people into theaters every time. You don't need gimmicks, and we don't need higher ticket prices. Anyway,
You know what brings people into movie theaters? Good stories. That's
exactly.
That's what brings them into. And you know one thing that's not going to bring them in?
What?
Is 48 frames per second.
All right, so this is The Hobbit. They showed some footage from The Hobbit. Obviously, one of the most anticipated films of the year, easily. It's a massive franchise. And Peter Jackson, like James Cameron, has been pounding the pavement talking about the virtues of shooting movies at 48 frames per second instead of 24 frames per second. He says it's just a remarkable leap in quality, akin, I would guess, to Blu-ray versus VHS tape. It's like anybody can see the difference. And it's remarkable and stunning. And he says it takes a little getting used to. But
it
then
does,
once you do, he says, and I found this interesting. It sort of made me think about the leap from DVD to, from VHS. He said, once you get used to watching footage in 48 frames and you go back to 24 frames, you notice all this flutter and you notice all this sort of little things and motion blur and all this stuff you weren't paying attention to before. And it becomes very annoying and you really can't go backwards. And I know that when I started watching DVDs, when I would go back and try and look at a VHS tape, I thought, oh my God. The quality in this is awful. I mean, I'm no techie guy, but VHS tape looked dreadful. And I literally have never watched a VHS tape again. It's so poor in comparison that you just don't want to go back.
That's what he says. That's actually a very good comparison, going from DVD to VHS, because I'm not a proponent of 48 frames per second. I'm going to just kind of, I'm going to take a neutral stance on this. Actually, no, I'm not. I'm not going to take a neutral stance on this. Peter Jackson was not able to be there. So, 2 years ago or a year ago, James Cameron showed up and gave this demonstration, this high frame rate HFR demonstration to everybody at CinemaCon, and he blew people out of the water. Now, what he showed was test content that he shot, he finished. It was an edited, color graded, timed presentation, and it looked phenomenal. And everybody was in a race to try and figure out how they were going to project this new tech, this new format, or not format, but this new type of, high frame rate content.
Exactly. And what Peter Jackson did was he showed up with footage from The Hobbit, which everyone wanted to see. He showed it in this new technology, and it was not ready for showing.
Right.
It was rough footage that had not been color corrected and refined to make it look the way he wants it to look. He's trying to tout this new technology, and he shows us raw footage. It's kind of like showing footage with like special effects not in there yet, and the sound is off and other things. You go, oh, I know it looks like crap, but it'll be better when we finish it. It's like, why did you show it if it wasn't ready to be seen?
Well, because they're trying to get theater owners to...
Showing them crappy versions of full frame.
I don't think that they really thought it through. Well, I don't know what they were thinking, frankly.
It'll be forgotten. It doesn't matter. It was a boondoggle. It's not going to hurt the movie. The movie, I'm sure they will do everything they can to make the footage look great, and it will look great because I'm sure he's tested it, et cetera. I mean, I shouldn't say that because you look at Tintin that he did with Steven Spielberg, and I think that motion capture animation thing looks terrible. It looks weird. I don't know how they could put that movie out and think this looks good. But I'm pretty confident that he will do The Hobbit right. And he's now said, yes, I showed this footage and there were a lot of things we didn't do that will be done once the movie is ready that, make it look better.
Yeah, I mean, people have been asking me, well, what did it look like? What did it look like? I mean, really, he was on screen first explaining that 24 frames per second was a speed or a shooting rate that was chosen because it was the lowest that you could go without seeing flicker, but it wasn't 55, which is really what you really want to not see flicker, because that would just eat up more film, which would have cost more money. But now with digital, you don't have to worry about that. So he chose 48 frames per second, and it's very difficult.
Is it just because it doubles 24? 55 is the idea. Why didn't it go to 55?
Because they're experimenting, and 48 is, yes.
It's easy to remember.
It's for technical reasons. And
okay.
Yeah, I mean.
I'm too stupid to understand.
And it's, yeah, it gets all physically.
I am, okay.
You know what I'm saying.
So, and he also said that there wasn't enough time in the movie to sink into the experience. Of course, it wasn't ready to be seen, but if you're looking at properly presented footage and you sink into the movie, it looks a little different at first, but you soon adjust and you follow into it. This was like cut together footage from different scenes, and therefore you never got to settle into it. It was too short, blah, blah, blah. So you couldn't really get a sense of how the 48 frame per second stuff worked. But tell us about just the glance of the footage at the movie. I assume the movie still looked intriguing.
Well, he says it takes 10 minutes for your eyes to adjust, and this was more than 10 minutes of footage. But it looked like watching a PBS Masterpiece Theater on video. Now, some of the exterior shots, helicopter, grand vistas.
But it looked too flat, sort of, I guess.
They looked amazing. No, because it was in 3D. They looked absolutely amazing. Some of this, the natural lit stuff. But the second they went inside and they had people talking and they were on a soundstage, it looked like a bad Irish soap opera. And it sounded like...
I'm sorry, keep going.
It was just not something... I mean, you could see what they might do is kind of color graded and put a filter over it to make it look more film-like and put...
That's what he said,
add a little bit more grain to kind of give it a wash that doesn't seem so video-esque. But he's using brand new cameras to shoot this, so he's using digital cameras, and it just did not look good. People walked out. Nobody wanted to say anything because they were like, wait a second. Did I just see that? Because that was horrible and that can't be right.
Given his explanation that it wasn't ready to be seen, to which case you say, well, you're a fool to show it. You don't need to get people excited by The Hobbit. And if you want to tout a new technology, make sure it looks good. Duh. But anyway, so they did the film with the service. They did 48 frames per second of service. So that's bizarre. But putting all that aside, was there any sense of the movie itself?
Yeah, I mean, the movie looks like it's going to be very much like the Lord of the Rings trilogy, except it's going to look different because it's A in 3D and B at this faster frame rate. I have a feeling that most of the prints and releases for this film will be in 24 frames per second, if only because most of the projectors out there and servers out there that are showing this in movie theaters can't actually do high frame rate yet.
Don't they just need a software upgrade?
It's not just a software upgrade. You have to have the media block that actually shows the film, that unlocks the film and puts it through the projector. It has to be inside the projector as opposed to in the server, which is where it is now for most installations.
But this is not a massive change for the industry, right? This is just, it's going to be a better looking image, or, you know, it's going to be, give them more flexibility or more clarity a la high def. Is that the idea?
Yeah, it really does look like ultra high definition television. I mean, ultra high def. It's not just high def. It goes beyond that. And it's really disconcerting when you first see it. And there were a whole bunch of demonstrations of high frame rate. There was some boxing footage that was shot at different rates. And they showed
it. So it's sort of like the difference between IMAX and regular film. I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of why we would be excited by it.
Because it really does look, you know, so hyper real. But the thing is, it looks hyper real. And rather than getting you more involved in the film, it's actually taking you out of it because you're going, wow, this really looks like.
Well, that would presumably end shortly. And my first reaction was that maybe it was sort of the problem that you had on television when they switched to high def. You had, you know, news anchor sets and all these things that they'd built that looked fine on regular cameras. But when you did it in high def, suddenly you realized the sets looked like sets, creaky, cardboardy, the makeup on the people was wrong. They had to adjust everything that they were doing. And for a second I thought, oh my God, have they shot this film and not realized that their sets are going to look like sets? Because it's too detailed and real. But I imagine his explanation about filtering and color correcting and all the things they need to do to make it look like a film will, in fact, take care of that problem. I certainly hope so.
Yes, and actually, that is the example I used. I used the same exact news desk kind of explanation for they're going to have to figure out a different way to shoot this. It'll be a different you'll have to relearn how to shoot. At 48,
and how to build
60.
Your sets and how to do camera and makeup and all that stuff.
Exactly, because it really is like, wow. I mean, some of the boxing stuff that they showed was, it looked almost like the Keystone Cops. It looked like they undercranked. It looked like they undercranked the film. I mean, they're all trying to, all of these vendors, all of these technology companies are trying to show how, you know, this will be beneficial. And in racing to try and do that, I don't think they did anybody any favors.
Well, you ready to move on to theater?
Absolutely, because I know that something happened a week ago. Something, you know, I remember you were telling me about this little off-Broadway show that you saw a while back, and you said, I have no idea why they thought this would work, and it shouldn't work, but it works, and that would be Once. That's right.
Yes, Once is the Irish musical that sort of was a worldwide independent hit. It made about $20 million. It won the Oscar for Best Song. The whole charm of the movie, I didn't love the movie like others, but the whole charm of the film was simply the performances of the two lead actors who were musicians who actually in real life fell in love and created this music together. And then they broke up, but that's another story. They still create music together. And the movie is just sort of the raw thing, but when they're making music, and that magic of people coming together and creating something was captured very nicely in the movie. Now, it's all linked to those two people. So the idea of making a musical about it without them just seemed bizarre. And yet it was a wonderful off-Broadway show. It's a wonderful show on Broadway. It's the best musical of the year. And it's reflected in the Tony Awards, where it got 11 nods, including Best Musical, Best Director, Best Actor and Actress, and Choreographer, and on and on and on. It's certainly the show to beat for Best Musical. So there were four shows up for Best Musical. That's Once. Nice Work If You Can Get It, a repurposing of Gershwin songs with Matthew Broderick in the lead. Newsies, the Disney musical based on the Christian Bale film. And Leap of Faith, another movie to musical thing. That's the Raul Esparza musical based on the Steve Martin film, which was a modest hit at best. That was turned into a Broadway show. It got only one award. Only one nomination. That's Best Musical, which shows you what a weak year it was. They didn't really want to honor this film in any other way, but they gave Leap of Faith Best Musical because there just weren't four shows good enough. You got Newsies, Nice Work, Once, and Leap of Faith. Leap of Faith is already set to close on Sunday. So that's too bad. How to Succeed in Business, by the way, is also closing. So if you want to see one of the Jonas Brothers, get to that soon. What happens every year at Broadway is that you have a showdown between a critic's favorite and a fan favorite. You know, there are the road producers are one of the biggest blocks of voters at the Tony Awards. Those are the guys that book the shows in Portland and Washington and Chicago and Cleveland and Miami. You know, they book these musicals all over the country, and they want fan-friendly musicals that are pre-sold that people can buy as part of a subscription and say, I can't wait to see Newsies. They already know what it is. So that is the favorite for them, and Once is the favorite for critics. And we're going to have to see which one of them comes out on top come Tony night.
Yes. Now there is one. Now we of course covered the whole idea of, you know, Broadway going on the road in episode 131 when we talked to Patrick Healy from the New York Times. One thing I did notice about this year's Tony nominations was there was one musical that was actually eligible for the Tony Awards this year, and I don't see it anywhere. Although it's, yeah, I think it has
Spider-Man. Turn off the
That's
dark.
That's right, exactly. You know what I love about the Tonys now is it. You know, you read the nominations. It sounds like you're reading the nominations for the Oscars.
That's right. Spider-Man did get one or two nominations. What were they?
In like minor
costume design,
yeah,
and scenic design. Neither one of which I would have given the show. Maybe scenic design, but costume design, I definitely would not. That was Aiko Ishioka. I did not like the costumes at all in Spider-Man. They didn't get song or anything else like that. It's just not a good show. I think Broadway is happy to see it there. They did a fun thing. As a sort of a tweak to the Tonys, Spider-Man announced today that on the day of the Tonys, when traditionally, you know, not a lot of shows are dark because people need to be ready to perform at the Tonys, Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark is having a 3 o'clock performance. And if your name is Tony or Anthony or Antoinette or anything like the Tony Awards, which were named after Antoinette Perry, they'll give you a free ticket to see the show on that Sunday of the Tony Awards. So run to the box office if your name is Tony.
So you're saying that on Tony night that most of the Broadway shows are dark.
The shows that are going to be performing on the show, I think, are dark. You know, or they have an afternoon performance. It depends on the show and what their schedule is like. You know, there are awards. Sometimes shows take the day off because they want to gear up for that night. Other shows do the performance during the day and then rush over to the Tonys. I think it depends on the show and the producers and how much. You know, it depends, of course. First, they have to be booked to perform on the show. You'll certainly see performances by Newsies with a bunch of young kids dancing around and selling newspapers. It's the male Annie. You'll certainly see Matthew Broderick and Kelly O'Hara performing from Nice Work if you can get it. You'll probably see Falling Slowly, the classic number from Once. You know, they'll probably do that montage they've been doing where they sort of have the group ensemble sing along and then they segue into that beautiful Oscar-winning song. It's a lovely show. Plays, of course, get the short end of the stick because you can't really present them well, doing an excerpt from a play. But there are four plays nominated for Best Play. They are Clybourne Park, the Pulitzer Prize-winning play about racism that keys off the classic play A Raisin in the Sun. You have Other Desert Cities by Broadway favorite John Robin Bates. You have Peter and the Starcatcher, a prequel to Peter Pan. And you have Venus in Fur, which has the breakout performance of Nina Arianda, who I think will win Best Actress in a Play.
Well, now, do you think Josh Young, who we were talking about just a few weeks ago as playing, you know, a wonderful Judas in Jesus Christ Superstar, he's nominated for Best Performance by a Featured Actor in a Musical. And he's up against, of all people, David Alan Grier, the comedian.
Well, David Alan Grier has done his, you know, theater work before. He's a well-established figure. I'd never seen him on stage, but he plays Sport and Life and Porgy and Bess, a show I really like, and it's not done as well at the box office as it should have. If you like, it's a great musical. Head on out to it. I encourage you, and you can probably get good seats. Audra McDonald is, of course, up for Best Actress in that. There's a lot of awards for that show. Norm Lewis is up for Best Actor. He was terrific as Porgy. It's up for Best Revival, of course, along with Evita, Follies, and Jesus Christ Superstar. I think it's probably a showdown between Follies and Porgy and Bess. Follies is already closed, though it's opening in L.A. right now. You can see that spurling.
Yeah, I know.
I think the theater lovers love Follies. It would be the third, you know, they would love to nominate. I think Porgy and Bess hopefully will squeak out in that one.
Well, you know, it seems like the Tony Awards will be a big deal, but in a couple of weeks when they actually hand them out.
That's right. So look for Clybourne Park to win Best Play, Once to win Best Musical, Porgy and Bess to triumph as Best Revival, and I think Death of a Salesman is the easiest pick. That is a lock to win Best Revival of a Play, along with Philip Seymour Hoffman as Best Actor.
Well, I have to say, hey, you know what? Linda Lavin, you said she was going to be nominated for Best Performance by Leading Actress in a Play, and you were right.
Well, that's no amazing pick there. There are usually just 5 or 6 or 7 people up for certain awards. She's a favorite of Broadway. She's a terrific actress, a beloved veteran. Of course, she was on the TV sitcom Alice. She faces Nina Arianda in Venus in Fur, who I think will win. Tracy Bennett as Judy Garland in End of the Rainbow, a show I did not like. Stockard Channing in Other Desert Cities. She's certainly a big rival for that one. Linda Lavin in The Lions, which has not really been tearing it up on Broadway. I was mixed on the show. I think she's good. And Cynthia Nixon from Sex and the City for the revival of Wit. I think it's going to come down to Nina Arianda versus Stockard Channing. Nina Arianda just gave a volcanic performance. I think she will be the fairy tale winner. Though, you know, Stockard could pull it off.
Well, I noticed just a moment ago, you did not take my bait when I said the words big deal, but it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Showbiz Sandbox really needs an in-house lawyer because another interesting legal case has hit the world of entertainment. The ABC reality series The Bachelor and its companion show, The Bachelorette, are facing a class action lawsuit led by Nashville residents, including football players Nathaniel Clay Brooks and Christopher Johnson.
If I knew football, I might know who those guys are.
And you might ask why that is. And that is because after 10 years and 23 seasons of these dating shows, not one lead bachelor or bachelorette looking for love has been a person of color. The pool of potential dates has been a little more multicultural, but in fact, there hasn't been one lead black person or Latino or Asian. Is this lawsuit a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's kind of interesting. As a fake lawyer, I would say it will be tossed out before it gets to trial because I can't see how they'll show any cause or how they can show any damages or have any, you know, place to sue. How can they prove that they suffered by not being chosen to be the lead performer in a show? If you're just saying they're discriminatory or they're racist, I don't see how that an individual can say that that means that they are damaging them. You know, it seems a weird case to make. It's kind of funny that it's a reality show getting this case because reality shows have proven to be really diverse. You look at the game shows and competition shows like Survivor and American Idol. You've seen gay people win the first season of Survivor. You've seen people of color, big people, heavyset people. You've seen a whole range of people presented a reality that's far more diverse and like the America we know than the primetime dramas and sitcoms. But in fact, if you look at The Bachelor and Bachelorette, they don't have a good record. They obviously are scared, rightly or wrongly, of having the lead person on the show being a black man dating white women, late Asian. You know, is that going to hurt them in the South? Is that going to hurt them elsewhere? Is that going to make them more controversial than they want? I think they're way behind America in this case, but I don't think you can make a legal judgment that they are causing you individually, you know, pain.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I didn't even know that The Bachelor was still on the air.
What are you talking about? Didn't you see? Oh, okay.
Well, Sinead O'Connor, we have been talking about her over the past year. We've mentioned her a couple of times. And I have to say, if you would have told me 2 years ago that we would be talking about Sinead O'Connor on this show or frankly, any show, I would have been a little surprised. And now we're talking about her again. She's had some good moments over the past year, some questionable moments. And now she is canceling her 2012 tour because she is fighting bipolar disorder. And her doctors advise her not to continue her tour.
Well, she's had her ups and downs, and we wish her the best. It's good that she's forthright about what the diagnosis has been. It's good to be out there and let people know that they're not alone when they deal with these issues. And it perhaps lets us know some of what's been going on with her. And perhaps a tour is not the best idea for her right now. But I hope she's a wonderful talent, and I hope she can continue to make music and get back, get her act together and be healthy and strong.
She played here in Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago or a month or so ago, and she got rave reviews. So I hope I've
never seen her live. It was one of the first or second album I got as a freebie to review. You know, it was one of the first albums when I went to college, and the guy said, "Hey, do you want to listen to one of these albums?" And I'd seen a teaser about her. I didn't know really who she was, but I'd seen a teaser in Rolling Stone about an artist to watch. And there was this album with this stark bald head, the lion and the cobra. And I said, "I'll take that." I'd never bought an LP, but it was an LP. And my roommate had one, took it home, put it on there, listened to the LP and was blown away by it. And I thought, "Oh my God," you know, I reviewed that album and then Prefab Sprout, another terrific British band. And I kept coming back with these raves. My editor was saying, "You know, you don't have to rave just because you got a free copy." I go, no, I'm not doing that. I'm telling you, these are really good albums. And I'm still talking about these acts 30 years later. Sinead O'Connor's a serious talent. Hasn't made a great album in a while, but she's made a good album, and I'd love to see her live, and I hope I get the chance someday.
Well, now, we were just talking about movie theater owners and exhibition. Well, it turns out that AMC Entertainment, one of the largest movie theater chains in the world and the second biggest here in the United States, looks like they very well may be sold to Wanda Group, which is a Chinese movie theater chain.
Wow, well, that's exciting. Usually you get a bunch of xenophobic reaction to foreigners investing in America. Instead of being excited that we're still in an area that attracts money, which should be the reaction, people say, oh my God, Japanese businessmen bought a piece of the Rockefeller Center. Japan's taking over America. And then later it becomes, oh my God, the United Arab Emirates is taking over America. Now, of course, we'll see China has taken over America. This is a good sign. It's a healthy sign. Theatrical exhibition is a worldwide business. There's no reason why you shouldn't have chains expanding beyond, you know, North America into other territories and other countries expanding here. I think it's healthy for the business, healthy for the economy, and healthy for China. And the more capitalism they have, the more likely they are to lead towards democracy. I know that's an old truism of the right, but I happen to agree with that one. And I think it's a big deal. I think it's exciting for theatrical exhibition and for the growth of the industry.
Well, you know, during CinemaCon, AMC announced, or they didn't announce, but somebody kind of made public that they weren't going to file an IPO,
summer. They delayed their IPO yet again because they were having trouble getting their act together.
Right. And, you know, they're owned by Apollo Investment, JP Morgan Partners, Bain Capital, and the Carlyle Group. So these are all private equity that's invested in this company. And you know what private equity wants to do. They want an IPO so they can cash out, or they want to sell so they can cash out. So I knew when they didn't do the IPO, they were going to sell. And the reality is the only people that can afford them are other large theater owners here in the U.S. or in North America. There's Cinepolis in Mexico that might be able to afford them. But you can't really sell to a Regal because of competition issues, you know, anti-competitive issues. So this kind of makes sense.
Well, the nice thing is if you partner with a Japanese exhibition company like Wanda, they'll know what people you should be bribing in the Japanese government in order to get the access you need.
Well, I think you mean the Chinese government because Wanda is a Chinese company.
Didn't I say Chinese?
You said Japanese.
Oh, I need to bribe the Chinese too, but the Japanese too. But yeah, I meant China because there's obviously a lot of bribery that you need to do to get business done there. It's very hard to get your money in and it's very hard to get your money out.
Now, I would assume that the reason you're mentioning this is our next story, which is about the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, investigating Hollywood studios for some alleged bribes that they're giving to different officials in China to try and smooth things over. Now, I have to tell you, as somebody who is not an expert on China, even I know that basically China runs on a gift economy, so to speak, where you're constantly kind of smoothing the way and oiling the wheels by, you know, giving a little money here to a particular person in power and, you know, a little money there to another person in power to get done what you need to get done. So now the SEC is saying, hey, you can't do that. There are laws against that. And they're investigating the five or six studios. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Yeah, I'd say this is a big deal because just because you're doing business overseas doesn't mean you get to break U.S. law. This is a complaint by U.S. companies regularly. They say, oh, we're competing with other companies around the world. It's tradition in China that you bribe people. It's the way business is done. It's a tradition in Hello, Italy. You got to bribe people in Italy to get business done. And they say, if we want to compete with against other countries, you can't tie our hands behind our back. Sorry, but you don't get to break the law. So, you know, I think it's a big deal and I think it's the right thing to do. And ultimately down the road, it will help them by not allowing them to do corrupt prop practices that will hold them down and hold back the countries that they're trying to do business in. You want to play above board, and it will hurt you short term, but help you long term.
Well, this next story, Amazon and I guess Ian Fleming Publications, they have now entered a 10-year licensing deal for at least North American rights to the entire James Bond catalog of books, which were written by, of course, Ian Fleming. For both print and ebooks. So is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It's a huge catalog acquisition, I think. James Bond is a perennial backlist bestseller. It's the sort of property you want to have. It's like having a valuable movie or TV show in your library. You're always going to sell James Bond books. They're always going to be successful for a long time to come. I don't believe this includes the James Bond books that have been done since he died by other authors. I think it's just the classic canon by Ian Fleming. I think it's English language rights, in fact, which might be interesting as well. I don't know if it's just North America or whether it's world English language. I think, you know, that's the trend we've been saying the publishing world is going into. This might be a case of that. I'm not sure. No, it's not, because the British rights are still held by somebody else.
That's right.
I stand corrected. So it is North American rights, but for them to acquire this valuable catalog is a very interesting move by them. And of course, print. Are other publishers going to carry it in print? Only if Amazon lets them sell the ebook version as well. So the more stuff that they get, the more they're going to be hurting themselves if they hold back from selling to people with Nooks and selling in Barnes & Noble stores and selling elsewhere, because they will not carry them unless Amazon lets them compete fairly by offering the ebooks as well. Interesting to see how that plays out. I say it's a big deal.
Well, just to stick with Amazon for a second, I'm going to skip ahead and then we'll go back. Amazon wants really to get into television, and not they're not going to make a television. They want to make television shows. They want to make both sitcoms and kid shows. Of course, Amazon Studios kind of crowdsourced movie ideas, and now they want to crowdsource.
And that works so well.
Well, you know, they had 15 different projects that they're, you know, that are on their development slate now, and their plan is to do the same thing for sitcoms and kid shows. And it, you know, if you can submit a script, and if your script, which should be 22 pages, by the way, if it's a comedy, or 11 pages if it's going to be a kid show. Or you could, you know, submit a 5-page series proposal. If they're selected, the writer will get a $10,000 check.
Otherwise known as nothing.
Yeah, option of the project. Or if it's produced, they're going to get $55,000, which I don't even think
it's scale. Also known as nothing.
Yeah, I don't even think that's scale. And up to 5% of Amazon's net receipts from toy and t-shirt licensing and all the other kind of royalties that you can squeeze out of Amazon. Now,
does that not include net receipts from the actual production and syndication and sale of the show itself?
I would imagine it does. Yeah, royalties. So yes, it would.
Okay.
So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It doesn't mean people won't stumble upon a good show that way. You know, fan fiction is not suddenly the world where you're going to find a million new good books just because 50 Shades of Grey popped up on the Twilight website where fans were writing fan fiction about that show. These ways of finding new stuff, yeah, you can stumble across a needle in a haystack, but this is not some brilliant new way of developing great TV shows. It's just a gimmick, frankly. And they might get lucky and find something, but this is not, this is the way of the future. No, it's just a contest. People have been doing it for many years in many different ways. Good luck to them. But, you know, if you got picked to do this, the only way you're going to make money is with your next project, because net receipts means absolutely nothing.
Well, you know, Jack White, within the past year, he broke up the White Stripes. He didn't break up, but the White Stripes, his first band, broke up. But now he's got a solo album out, and it hit number one. It sold 138,000 copies in its first week, which bested Adele's 21, which was number two at 84,000. He's been in any number of bands, the White Stripes, the Raconteurs, the Dead Weather. But this is his first number one album. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal for him. I'm happy for him. But how sad it is to see that there is only one album on the Billboard charts that sold more than 100,000 copies. That is just unbelievable. It's hard to wrap my head around it. Movies are making more money than ever, but music has really felt the bite of piracy. And you're seeing a lot of studies and things saying, no, music piracy really hasn't hurt the business. I'm sorry, there are no record stores and people do not buy albums anymore. How did they suddenly lose the interest in buying music? I don't need albums to make 8 million or 10 million copies a year like they used to, but people just are not buying music, and it's a very sad day.
Well, let's stick with music for a second and kind of move along to The X Factor, which is searching for its fourth judge. Simon Cowell's U.S. edition of The X Factor is ramping up its choice of judges, and Cowell and L.A. Reid, who are the two judges from the first season here in the U.S., will be joined by Britney Spears and Demi Lovato. Cowell was keen on getting the show a younger demographic with Britney on board. Apparently, they also needed a brunette. So Q Lovato, the former Disney star who will be 20 years old when season 2 launches in the fall, so she's got a wealth of experience. Lovato is not a huge force musically, but she's a Disney Channel mainstay and has already been in a treatment facility for personal issues, so she knows the pressure of showbiz just like Britney Spears. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, Lovato is not confirmed yet, but it seems likely they're about to make a deal. I think it's a big deal. I think the show is going to face The Voice. The Voice is probably going to move to the fall. If they don't do it twice a year, they're going to probably at least move NBC's The Voice to the fall because it's the only hit they have outside of football. I think it's a good move. You'll never know how Britney Spears and Lovato will work with L.A. Reid and Simon Cowell. It's all about chemistry. You don't know until they get together in the room, but she's an interesting mix, and it's shocking to me that Britney Spears is the older person, and to get a younger demo, they need somebody else. I still think of Britney Spears as that young, you know, artist, but in fact, she's been in the industry for quite a while. So Lovato, 20 years old, can't get much younger than that.
Yeah, I mean, if she were 18, I mean, you know, what advice is she going to
do? Yeah, she'd have to do homework. If she was any younger, she'd have to do homework on this set before she judged people.
Exactly. Well, now let's stick with music again for a moment. And Talk about the Jonas Brothers. They're leaving Hollywood Records. They're buying back their masters and their publishing. They did the same thing, by the way, when they when Columbia, well, dumped them. Broadway, film, reality TV, websites, apps. It said they have a new logo. As you mentioned, How to Succeed in Business starring Nick Jonas closed on Broadway or is closing on Broadway. So is this whole Jonas Brothers news a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop as far as whether they're a spent force or not. We don't know yet. They've all got solo projects going on. They've all been, you know, in theater and film and solo albums. I think it's fascinating about how they've kept control of their music. That's very unusual, but they're smart to do it. They think there's a lot of potential down the road, and they're talented guys. And I think when they get back together, they're going to be, you know, it's been a few years since they've had some Jonas Brothers hysteria. I think there's every reason to think that they can produce good music again. And when they own those masters and the publishing rights to those songs, that's going to make it all the more valuable for them to succeed and be able to create stuff like an app or a website and all these sort of things that will you know, benefit their catalog and make them more profitable. So I think they're not a spent force creatively. It's really hard to segue from boy band into, you know, adult. More likely if somebody goes solo and has success like Nick or Joe. You know, that's more often what happens. Joe Jonas, of course, will become president someday. We know that. But I think they'll make the transition. I have faith in them because I think they're very talented. So I think it's interesting. I think it is a big deal. You know, you're always smart to keep your publishing, always smart to own your masters. Whatever they spent, it's probably worthwhile.
Now, I guess this really doesn't have anything to do with music, but you might recall a while back we were talking about the theater in which the Academy Awards are held. It used to be called the Kodak Theater. Kodak filed for bankruptcy, and they wanted to take their name off the theater so that they could stop those $4 million payments to the group that owns the theater over there at the Hollywood and Highland Center. Well, now it looks like the Academy Awards Theater has a brand new name, and it's the Dolby Theater. Dolby, of course, we've mentioned them a couple times on this episode. Dolby's going to, it's a 20-year deal. So, big deal or big whoop?
It's the definition of a big whoop. But why didn't they call it the Atmos Theater, whatever that new sound system is? What's it called?
Atmos. It's supposed
Atmos.
To stand
they should
for...
They should have called it the Atmos Theater because nobody would know what it is.
That's right. It's supposed to stand for atmosphere.
Oh, really?
I think so, yes. Don't quote me on that. But, you know, I just wonder, well, how do you think the sound's going to be in that theater?
Yeah, it
better be darn
be
good.
Sterling.
Yeah, exactly. Well, moving along to our final story here, Paulo Coelho, who we all met in Cannes a couple of years ago, he has lowered the price of all of his ebooks.
I didn't meet him. Did you meet him?
Yeah, just in passing. But, you know.
Oh, okay.
And we became Twitter buddies for all of about, you know, a year. Before he like unfollowed everybody. But anyway, you can buy his ebooks now for $1, all except his most popular and famous book, The Alchemist. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's sort of an interesting big deal. It's really a big whoop. He's always said piracy does not hurt. He's made his books available in countries where they couldn't be bought properly. He's made ebooks available for free for a while. He knows people are taking them, so it makes it easier for them to do it. Or if he doesn't have the ebook rights or he doesn't want to find the right publisher yet, he'll make the ebook available, you know, that way. And he says ebook piracy and people reading ebooks for free lead to print sales. What he's forgetting is that print sales aren't going to be around much longer. And I think it's fascinating they did it for every book except the one that's his most popular by far. So he didn't quite put his money where his mouth is. But hey, he's made like 10 or 12 books available for $1 as ebooks. I think that's a little too cheap. He's an established author. There's no reason they should be $1. When I think $5 is inexpensive. $8 is inexpensive. I think that's a fair price for a portable book. But hey, he wants to make it $1 because he thinks if you buy his books and love them, you're going to want to buy a print edition and give it as a gift or put it on your library shelf. At least, you know, he's taking the gamble, and after years of saying piracy doesn't hurt, he's really showing that he believes it. So it'll be interesting to see how his sales work out.
You know, that's exactly what I did with the latest Lady Gaga album. I bought it, what was it, like 99 cents. I bought the whole album. I loved it, went out and bought it in CD form, and then put it on my shelf.
Did you?
Yeah, no, I didn't.
No. And, you know, an interesting aside, Tor is one of the big publishers of sci-fi and fantasy. They're a big publishing imprint, and they just announced that they're going to drop DRM, which is digital rights management restrictions, on its ebooks. That'll make it easier for people who buy a book from one store to place it on another, you know, device, whether you buy, you know, the Tor ebook for your Kindle or your Nook or your iPad or some other device down the road, it's a lot easier for you to get it back and forth. It's like when Apple dropped the digital rights management on its, on its digital music, it became easier to switch it back and forth from the iPod and the iPhone to other devices like your computer and other tablets and other things that you want to use. And it's a really important step forward. I think it's a big deal. I think every publisher dropped DRM. All it does is frustrate your hard paying consumers, and it doesn't stop pirates for a single second. So it's pretty darn stupid. And the sooner they all dump it, the better.
Yeah, but I mean, let's face it, a 1 megabyte book, okay, can be stuffed into an email and sent to 400 of your closest friends in a heartbeat. So that's why DRM is there. I'm not saying it's right. I'm taking no stance on this, but you can see why. I mean, it's a very small file that can be instantly shared with the masses. And so they want to just like songs, correct.
Right. But DRM does not stop piracy. All it does, it doesn't stop real piracy. It just stops me from being able to switch it back and forth between my devices. If I buy something on Amazon Kindle, I should be able to move that, book to another device easily. Or I should be able to, I shouldn't be restricted in any way of using it fairly. And that's what DRM does. I don't think it stops piracy. I know people who steal books from, pirate websites where they can get every book as soon as it comes out. I'm like, don't do that. I don't like that. But I don't think DRM prevents that. It doesn't. So I don't understand. All it does is make it more difficult for you, a fair consumer who bought it, to use it properly. I understand why they wanted to put it there and why their purpose is and why they think it's going to slow down piracy. I just don't think it will.
Well, then maybe you can help explain our Inside Baseball story. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. I think that this next story actually does have the industry buzzing. It is about the Village People song YMCA, which the songwriter reclaimed the rights in a court case.
That's right. We've been talking for a while about this copyright rule that was passed that said after 35 years for songs published after 1978 or later, after 35 years, you can reclaim the songs under certain circumstances. You have to start filing them. And that's why a year or two before it expires, that 35-year gap. And that's why we started to see lawsuits in 2011 and 2012 working their way through the court. A lot of artists like Bob Dylan and the Eagles and all these big names who had albums out in 1978 and later are finally starting to have their albums come up, and the option for them to try and reclaim copyright control over their own music is available to them. And of course, it's all going to be legal cases. And one of the first people to file a lawsuit was Victor Willis. He's a singer, and he had songwriting credit on a bunch of songs recorded by the Village People and others. He had about 33 songs that he had rights to that he was trying to reclaim his personal copyright control over. And they include YMCA, one of the biggest hits of all time. And this song is a massive perennial success story. If you own the publishing rights to YMCA, you'd be a very happy person indeed. So this guy, Victor Willis, filed a lawsuit and has gotten up to another level. And a California federal judge has just ruled that he does, in fact, have the right to reclaim this song and the publishing rights to it. And there's a lot of things that went on in this case. Number one, it's one of the first ones to go to trial. And the publishers, who also want to know what's going to happen with all this, they waived the right to one big argument that's going to keep coming up. They waived the right to argue that these songs were, quote unquote, works for hire, which is a very tricky.
That's the big thing. That's the big issue here, because all the record companies are saying no, you don't. We hired you to sing YMCA, so it's a work for hire. It's
to write it.
To write it. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Right. The problem with this is in the record industry, as we've explained before, is that they usually charge you for the right to you record an album for a record label, and they say, hey, you can record an album. We'll just charge you $600,000. You can use the studio and all that. You run up a bill, and when a song is a hit, if God willing it is a hit, they start to detract all those expenses from you. So when you pay to record the album, you write the song, you pay to record it, you pay for every little bit of it, and it's charged you by the record company to claim that even after all that, they hired you to work for it and it's just a work for hire. It doesn't make any sense. It's not like a movie where you make a movie for $200 million. They don't ever expect you to pay the $200 million back. But when you record an album, the record label charges you for the pleasure of doing that, and it deducts all that money from your profits. So, if you write it and you pay to record it and you pay to put it out and you pay for their PR and you pay for everything they do, how in the heck are you working for them? And that's going to be a very hard argument to make. But, you know, that's going to be another case is going to have to tackle that. Right now, these publishers said, fine, we're not going to argue that because we want to see what happens if we don't. And they went to trial and they waived that right. And the judge said that the argument that, you know, that this was not his song and he didn't have the right to it is crazy. One of the big things is that he's one of three songwriters on YMCA, for example. And the publisher said, hey, you got to get the other two guys, or at least one of them, to also terminate the rights, or you don't have enough control over the song. It has to be a majority control over the song.
So it had to be more than 50%.
Right. More than 50% have to claim the right to retain it. And he says, no, if you have a percentage of it, you can reclaim your percentage. The next thing is that you don't need to stick with the deal that you had. The publisher said, okay, it's not a work for hire. Okay. Say that you rule he has the right to terminate the copyright and retain control of his song's publishing. All right. But we made a deal with him and he gets, say, like 12% of this song or 15% of another song. His royalty rates vary from song to song from 12% to 20%. They said, whatever deal we made, you know, he's got to stick to that percentage, you know, because that was the deal we made. And the judge said, no, he doesn't. You know, the whole point of this copyright ruling, the whole point this was put into place was because people made the best deal they could, but they're at a huge disadvantage when they're just starting out. They make pretty weak deals. And they're saying, all right, you were a young guy starting out. Nobody knew if the song would be a hit. You made the best deal you could. But now, 35 years later, the song has proven very successful and you want to reclaim the rights. You're not stuck with the lame deal you made 35 years ago. You're not just a new kid on the block. You're someone who's created YMCA, one of the most enduring songs of all time. That's a huge financial success. There's no reason why you should have to maintain the rights that you had back then. You get to do the best you can. So this guy maybe went from 12% to maybe 33% because he's one of three people who claim authorship on this song. There's three official co-credited songwriters on YMCA. So now maybe his deal was 12% of YMCA. Now it could go up to 33% or more.
And this is only for songs that were written and after a certain, I think, 1975 or 76, somewhere in there?
No, 1978, because okay. It's 2013 when they start to come on board. But you have to start filing your lawsuit now.
You have to start the reclaiming process now.
Right, or within the next few years. You don't want to wait because they will expire after a certain period.
5-year window, right.
That's right. So there's no reason to wait. You should start now. In this case, we're talking about 33 songs. He might have another 10 or 20 or 50 songs in 1979 that will come on board a year later, and 1980 a year after that. I'm not sure how early you can start to file lawsuits. I think it's been pretty much just the last year or two, 2011, 2012. That's why we've been talking about it.
Well, I don't think it's lawsuits so much as it is you actually have to go through the process of reclaiming it. And then once the
Well, they're going to court. He filed the thing and then they sued saying he doesn't have the right to do it.
Right. And I think that the reason that the record company did not want to argue the work for hire is not only did they want to see what would happen in this case, but they didn't want there to be a precedent set that if they lost this case, okay, it's one thing, they lost the case and they have to return the rights. But if they lost this case and they lost the work for hire issue, then that sets a precedent that will just kind of ripple through the entire industry.
Well, I'm certain that they felt this wasn't the best case for whatever reason to make the work for hire argument. I think it's an incredibly hard argument to make in general. And I don't know the particulars of Victor Willis and what his deal was with Scorpio Music and Can't Stop Productions. Those are the two companies that own the rights to the songs. I'm not sure how it came together. The Village People is a very interesting case, though, because they were sort of a put together group. With, you know, they're sort of a fake group. So it was probably a really good example of a work for hire, you know, the best case they could possibly make, you know, sort of like the Monkees in a way. So I'm not sure how much of a better case they could come up with for work for hire. If you're looking at Bob Dylan, you're going to tell me the Eagles and Bob Dylan are work for hires? Give me a break. So the Village People, which is sort of a more quote unquote fake band or put together band more by people behind the scenes, that seems to me the ideal case for work for hire. So for whatever reason, they didn't feel this was the case to make the claim. I'm sure a publisher is going to make that claim with the best possible situation that they can, something like the Monkees or something where it really is a put together band by the behind the scenes person who still controls the rights, like, you know, the original Backstreet Boys and NSYNC were. They were brought together by a producer behind the scenes who made them happen. So, you know, when you're brought in and auditioned to become part of a group that somebody is creating, that's a really good example of a work for hire. But how that affects the songwriters and how that affects these lawsuits, I don't know. But this is a really important case. It's fascinating, and I can't wait to see what happens.
I can't believe that you'd say they were fake. I mean, how could you say that? I mean, look, don't you think most bands are comprised of a cowboy, a motorcycle guy, an Indian, an American Indian, a police officer, and a construction worker?
They are in my world.
Well, you know, and Victor Willis played the police officer.
There you go. God bless him.
Yeah. So, well, you know, good for him. And, you know, there's not really much more I could say about that.
Yeah. And the emails this week were all about, where are you guys? We apologize for the delay. I know you send your best wishes to my dad, the people, once they realize what was going on. And I appreciate that. And hopefully we'll be back on track soon.
That's right. And if you do want to send us emails, you can do so. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace, on Stitcher, or however you download or listen to podcasts. And please do rate and review our shows on any of those podcast aggregators. It really does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. And that's where you'll find all of that contact information and ways to follow us. We're on Twitter. Our username is showbizsandbox. We're also on Facebook, where our username is, ironically, showbizsandbox.
Is that ironic?
I don't know.
Maybe according to Alanis Morissette's usage of the word, but I don't think that's ironic.
I don't know. Well, surprisingly, I don't know. I don't know what the right word there would be. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. It is
michaelgiltz.com. You can also find me on Huffington Post, where you'll find out exciting things like, oh my God, there's going to be a sequel to The Avengers. I can't believe it. The least surprising announcement in Hollywood history.
Right. Kind of like our username on Facebook being Showbiz Sandbox, since our podcast is called Showbiz Sandbox.
Exactly.
Yes. In any case, you can find some of my writing on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
Now back to the hospital, where I'm feeling run down because there's no better place to get sick than in a hospital. It's always the case. I'm feeling completely run down and nauseous. I'm like weak. I've got hot flashes. I'm clammy. So people, when you're listening to this podcast, wear a mask or something.
You know, are you going through menopause?
No, I thought so for a second. Believe me, it was all I could think of. And scene.